Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's special meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley with co-host FACTS, Foundation for American Communications, brought to you from the Wyndham Hotel in San Jose. I am David Yarnold, executive editor of the San Jose Mercury News. We want to welcome the listeners of KKGO-FM in Los Angeles, one of the more than 225 stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here and on the radio to visit us on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Today we are going to talk about the role of the press in this new age of Internet technology. Newspapers are going through big changes, but the role of the press remains to keep citizens informed in a democracy. FACTS, the co-sponsor of today's lunch, is dedicated to improving the content of news by expanding the knowledge of reporters in business, economics, science, technology, healthcare, and many other subjects that are so important to our readers. Regardless of the medium to communicate information, the quality of news content is essential. And now, I'd like to introduce Mr. Jess Marlowe, our moderator for today's panel, a man who has spent his life striving to improve the content of television news. You may remember Mr. Marlowe from his early days as a newscaster at San Jose's KNTV, Channel 11. From that early experience, he has gone on to become one of Southern California's best-known and most well-respected broadcasters. Highlights from his long and distinguished career include being among the first American journalists admitted into the Republic of China in 1979 and being the only local American TV reporter permitted into Vietnam on the 10th anniversary of the war's end. He has conducted interviews with Presidents Ronald Reagan and John F. Kennedy and numerous other American political figures. He is also a founding trustee of FACTS. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Jess Marlowe to the Commonwealth Club podium.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be back in San Jose. That was a very long time ago at KNTV, working as a reporter, and it's a thrill to see some very familiar faces in this audience from many years ago, and it's a delight to be here. When I was here in 1961, there was no Silicon Valley. There are some who suggested I was here before there was Silicon. Not true. Today we are joined by five individuals whose careers have done a lot to shape the news industry. Robert Giles is the executive director of the Media Studies Center, the nation's premier media think tank, senior vice president of the Freedom Forum. Previously, he was editor and publisher of the Detroit News, which he joined in 1986. He is one of the few editors who has served as president of both the American Society of Newspaper Editors and the Associated Press Managing Editors. Under his leadership as editor, two newspapers, the Akron Beacon Journal and the Detroit News, have received Pulitzer Prizes. He is a former FACTS chair. Robert Giles. Next to him, Jay Harris has served as publisher of the San Jose Mercury News since 1994. Mr. Harris joined Knight Ridder as executive editor of the Philadelphia Daily News. He went on to serve as vice president of operations. He served as a national correspondent for the Gannett News Service and worked as a reporter and editor in Wilmington, Delaware. Mr. Harris was also a member of the faculty of the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. He is currently chair of the Bay Area Council. Jay Harris. Alan Horton has served as senior vice president of Scripps Howard newspaper since 1994. Previously, he was vice president of newspaper operations for the company. His 30-year career in print journalism included service as editor of the Naples Daily News, as a reporter for the Cincinnati Post, Cleveland Press, and as a national correspondent for the Scripps Howard News Service. His coverage in Washington focused on the Pentagon and national security affairs during the Vietnam War. As a current chair of the Newspaper Association of America's Readership Task Force, Mr. Horton focused extensively on the future role of newspapers in society. He is a former chair of FACTS. Alan Horton. Next to him, John Opadol is publisher and CEO of the Arizona Republic and Arizona Business Gazette. Mr. Opadol began his career at the San Francisco Examiner, served as assistant managing editor of the Detroit Free Press, plus other roles as an editor or reporter at the Dallas Times-Herald and the Los Angeles Herald-Examiner. At the Arizona Republic, he has served as executive editor and managing editor. Mr. Opedal is well known for his progressive, innovative leadership in newspapers. He received his B.A. in political science from the University of California at Berkeley and a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University. J. Opedal, John Opedal. David Talbot's leadership and editor, and as editor and founder of Salon.com, has garnered web awards, press accolades, and a large and growing readership. Salon.com was named Best Website of 1996 by Time Magazine. Before starting Salon.com, Mr. Talbot was arts and features editor for the San Francisco Examiner. He also served as editor of the paper's Sunday magazine, Image. He was senior editor of Mother Jones magazine and has won many national magazine awards. Newsweek named him as one of the 50 people who most matter on the Internet. David Talbot. That's your panel, and I know you have many questions for them, and I hope you'll be writing those down and bringing them up to us when you can. The title of this panel is The Role of the Press in the Internet Age. My first question would be, is there to be a role for the traditional press, read that print, in the Internet Age? Alan?
You're picking on me already. There is, and part of it, part of the reason there is because there still are a lot of people, and there will be for as long as most of us in this room are alive, who still want to have a print newspaper. But it may not be recognizable as something akin to today's when we look at it 30 years from now. I think there are two things that a newspaper will always be able to provide. One is a real sense of having a record for what's going on in your local community. And the second is something that you can clip and send to grandma or put on the refrigerator. And even though we can do all this stuff electronically today and in the future we'll be doing it electronically, it's something we'll still want to do with print. And I've talked to a lot of people in this room and a number of people who are as wired as you can be today. And even they say they would be lost without the newspaper. Now, many of them may read it on the web. That's fine. We don't care. We in the print business want you to read it on the web if you don't want it in print or vice versa. We're going to have to do it both ways, and we plan to do that.
Maybe we should also ask Bob Giles from Media Studies Center what their research would indicate on that.
Well, we haven't done any research that is worth noting, but I would like to enlarge the discussion a little bit by making two points. First is that the core of in the Internet, in a great sense, is journalism. The skills of gathering information, analyzing it, writing it, and disseminating it. In the Freedom Forum's discussions with journalism schools and journalism educators, we're somewhat concerned to discover that the journalism curriculum is not changing to effectively reflect the opportunities and the demands of teaching students for to report and develop careers for the Internet, for the technology, as well as for the journalism. The faculties and the the directors of the journalism schools seem to be well behind the curve in recognizing the great potential and the meaning for it in the future of their journalism schools. The second observation I would like to make is the great value that the Internet is demonstrating around the world in countries where there is a evolving but very fragile free press. Many of these countries where there is a repressive government that is working against the establishment of a free press. I've participated in a number of Freedom Forum conferences around the world in countries where these conditions exist. And it is very heartening to hear stories by journalists who are using the Internet as a very effective way of getting around government repression And our experience suggests that the Internet is going to be a very powerful force in developing and sustaining a free press on a global basis. In one of our conferences in Kenya 2 years ago, we had a panel of editors from around that part of Africa talking about their experience, and there was a young editor from Nigeria who was talking with considerable pride about the success that he and his colleagues were having in getting information out to the people of Nigeria in spite of the restrictions being imposed by the government. When he went back home 2 days later, he was arrested by the government at the border and spent 6 months in prison. He was finally released through some of our efforts, but more importantly, the Committee to Protect Journalists. But the point is that journalists in some very risky situations where courage is in great demand are using the Internet in a most effective way, and they're demonstrating that probably repressive governments, totalitarian governments, can never repress a free press because of the new technology that the Internet is enabling.
I dare say no one on this panel or in this room questions the real value of the Internet, but it clearly has some problems. It does have some flaws, and part of that is in its journalism and the absence of an editor. Jay Harris, are you concerned that with the Internet everybody is his or her own editor?
No, actually, I'm not concerned about that, because it seems to me that one of the values of that, 2 points. First is that one of the values of the Internet is that it expands access to a wide variety of people to what we might think of as public discourse. And I think that's all for the good. I think, though, that suggests that there will be a change in the definition of what we think of as a journalist. It is also important, I think, to keep in mind that we are at the absolute beginning of the development of a new medium. It is still immature. It is in some ways a medium which suffers currently from a lack of set standards and values, and I'm sure it will improve. I would say also, though, to go to some questions that you raised earlier, Jess, that it seems to me that this issue points to one of the roles of the traditional press as this new medium evolves. I think that the maturity, the standards, the values that are at the heart of and are the foundation of traditional news organizations will be increasingly appreciated and standard setting in a way in the Internet world. And that one of the things that our news organizations will increasingly do is sort of establish, if you will, the high end of the value proposition of the news and information continuum on the Internet. And that, I think, is actually a very hopeful and exciting place for our organizations to be. I'm very hopeful about how our organizations will evolve in this new medium.
There's been considerable concern about some of the content of the Internet and its unregulated content on the Internet. Do you all agree that there is great concern for the First Amendment if there is an effort to regulate content of the Internet?
Yeah, I think that's got to be an issue for anybody interested in the history of the United States and where we go forward. There's an economic argument as well. If you believe that people now are going around saying that news is a commodity, and I think news has always been a commodity. Journalism is the value, to quote a friend of mine, David Hall, who's an editor back east, journalism is the value that gets added to news. And right now the only institution in our country that has the economic wherewithal to collect a lot of information locally and present it is the daily newspaper. If you look at most cities and add up all the television or radio reporters, they're far fewer in number than at a significant newspaper or a dominant newspaper. And that economic engine allows that news to be collected because news costs a lot. And the issue for your original question, I think, and it also speaks to the First Amendment issue, the protection of the First Amendment to some degree is guaranteed by the economic enterprise that is the daily newspaper. And if that economic underpinning is eroded, as it inevitably will, the current situation that everyone's focused on is classified advertising. But if that economic wherewithal is threatened, there is going to be some erosion of the value that is added to news by journalism. And there, as far as I can tell on the Internet, is no other effort that gets paid enough money to pay reporters to collect enough local news. And that is a serious issue. And I think that's the heart of your original question about whether or not newspapers are going to be replaced or not.
David?
Yeah, I think that John's remarks are very to the point. I speak as someone who is a veteran of newspapers, who is now very much a advocate and a participant in this Internet press revolution. But I worked with at the Examiner with Will Hurst when he was still publisher there a few years back. And I think what John says is absolutely correct, that newspapers are still the only place where there's a sufficient investment in editorial content to make a difference in those local communities. And yet I also want to go on to, I think, break some of the mood of some of the self-congratulation maybe here. This is my role, I'm sure, as a representative of the Internet. I feel like one of the kids up in Seattle right now. I've got to smash some windows to fulfill my role.
That's why we kept you to last.
But I do feel that despite the centrality, the supreme importance of the newspaper industry in this country, much more important than television, with all due respect to Jess, having the sheer number of reporters and editors who are producing news every day. Despite that, I think the newspaper industry really needed a wake-up call by the 90s when the Internet came along. I compare it really to the state of Detroit in the early 1970s before Japan forced the big three auto companies to wake up to the fact that they'd been too smug, too complacent, too fat, and too monopolistic. And I think that's not healthy for any industry. And that certainly has been the case with the newspaper industry increasingly in the United States. They've become more and more of a one, each city has one newspaper. They've grown fat and happy in that position. But as a result, I think they lost some of their enterprising spirit. I think they become very dull. I think the chains, newspaper chains, have imposed a kind of cookie-cutter kind of feel to newspapers that readers don't like anymore. I think they're hemorrhaging readers, particularly young readers, at alarming rate. And now we're seeing the same kind of hemorrhaging in advertising and classifieds. So I think the Internet, should be looked at as a wake-up call by the newspaper industry. I think, by and large, the newspaper industry has been slow to respond to this challenge. And the challenge is this. Internet companies like Salon are out to eat the lunch of their competitors, which are newspapers online and offline. And we try to be scrappier. We take more risks. We're more enterprising. We have to because we're smaller. We're not as well financed. And we have to make a splash. And we are making a splash in various ways by breaking stories that the rest of the press won't. Just to use one example, Columbine. We broke a story about a month ago on the Columbine High School diaries, the site of the terrible tragedy in Colorado last year, the high school. These diaries were known. These were the diaries by one of the kids who was one of the shooters there. Those diaries, the contents of those diaries, were known to the local press, to the newspapers there. And basically, what the contents of these diaries did was to undermine a lot of what was conventional wisdom about the shooting, including the very dramatic case of the young woman, the Christian, who apparently had stood up to the two shooters and said, "Yes, I am. I do believe in Jesus," and then was shot. According to the investigators, based on these diaries and other material they had, this wasn't the case. And yet, because of the strong feeling in these communities, because of the strong feeling particularly on the part of the religious communities in Colorado, the newspapers weren't reporting this story. Well, Salon, you know, feels, and internet companies have to feel, that there should be no fear or favor when reporting the news. We're willing to take risks that perhaps some local newspapers aren't in those cases, and we broke that story. You know, the upstarts, the challengers on the internet are saying something loud and clear, I think, to the newspaper industry. You can't be a smug anymore. You can't sit on your laurels. Just because you have the only monopoly in town when it comes to newspapers, it doesn't mean that monopoly is going to exist online in the internet world. And you've got to start, being more competitive.
I think these gentlemen who are competing with you would have a response to that. Bob Giles mentioned he has one, from Bob Giles from Media Studies Center.
Well, actually, my response goes to the previous question about the First Amendment. I think the First Amendment issue is a very serious one. The courts to this date have done a good job of upholding First Amendment values, but I think the appetite among legislators to somehow control access to expression and information and images on the internet is insatiable. And this is going to be a continuing battle between the legislative and the judicial branches of this country, and it's a risk that someday the Supreme Court may approve, may uphold a legislative approach that will limit free speech. And I think the legislators in this country are aware that the public support for the core values of the First Amendment are deteriorating. The Freedom Forum does an annual survey called the State of the First Amendment, and in the last one that we did earlier this year, in response to the question, do you think the press has too much freedom under the First Amendment, 53% of the respondents said yes. Now, that's very scary, and that's a big increase from our last survey 2 years ago when 39% gave the same response. So it indicates to us that there is a growing disaffection with the freedoms of the press under the First Amendment. This is bound to influence legislative initiative, and perhaps it will influence court decisions down the road.
Clearly, that's a wake-up call for both internet and the traditional press. But would somebody like to respond to the challenges David Talbot from Salon offered?
I would, and mostly I'd like to first say that I think he's basically right, that we needed a wake-up call. There's no question about that. I think we've accepted that wake-up call as a challenge and as an opportunity, and I believe we're responding well. But let me get back to Columbine for a second, because I think that brings up an important point. Scripps happens to own two newspapers in that area, the Denver Rocky Mountain News and the Boulder Daily Camera. In Denver, we devoted 64 pages a day and over 100 staffers for 2 months to that story, and not just what happened at Columbine, but what is happening, the bigger issue, what is happening with our young people, with our values, and all of the other issues that were raised by that. David probably doesn't realize it, but we had a whole bunch of people spending several weeks with students at a nearby high school, not Columbine, in the same general geography, and did a special section on what those kids told us about what they thought about Columbine, which I think taught the entire Denver area about what lessons we should draw from this. I think it would be a mistake to assume that because you broke a story on one aspect, diaries, that you can just assume that the newspapers in greater Denver did not cover this this tragedy with a heck of a lot more depth, persistence, and quality than was available, in my opinion, anywhere on the internet. That's the first point. The second point is that even though this is going to change over time, today we still haven't reached the critical mass in most of America where the Internet can really reach as many people as newspapers do today. And newspapers are moving to the web in a rush. Most newspapers today are on the web. And let me just bring up another point that John raised that I think is absolutely critical. The bottom line for journalism is going to be, is there an economic base for it? Is there going to be enough money to support the kind of journalism that the public deserves?
He mentioned classified, but what other resources?
He mentioned classified. Let me tell you something the web has taught newspapers in this regard. We're going to lose certain categories of classified in some communities. There's no question about that because it works better on the web. But the newspapers are, I hope, going to be some of those providing that. The rates are going to go down. But one of the things that the web allows is advertisers can target specific individuals because of their behavior. Their behaviors, I should say. And we are learning in the newspaper business how to do that too, not only on the web, but in print. And we thank all of you in this audience who have helped teach us that lesson. And another point that's been brought up today is we talked about whether or not government is going to have restrictions on what we would consider to be unfettered First Amendment.
Right.
I think maybe a bigger issue is what is going to happen to tax policy with regard to e-commerce. And I'd be interested. I mean, my personal view is that there's a growing feeling in the state legislatures of this country that they're in deep trouble because local communities rely so heavily on local sales taxes. They're in deep trouble as e-commerce grows and grows. And the federal government is trying to figure out how to come up with some kind of a federal sales tax that then might be reallocated in some way to the states or might not. And in the long run, I think the tax, that's just one. I'm not going to take everybody's time, but there are a whole series of those kinds of tax issues that I think are a bigger threat to the First Amendment than the direct frontal assault on the First Amendment issues.
Let me, because we've gotten questions from the audience, I must tell you that they generally fall into two categories. One is the concern about the First Amendment, and the other is a significant concern about the content of the web. For instance, Pat writes, with everyone able to put anything and everything on the Internet, how are we going to know what is the truth, what is real? How will we determine the credibility of information? Jay Harris, would you take that?
Sure, because I really think that it goes to the heart of why I'm really actually very optimistic about the role that major news organizations with strong traditions and values will play, because they will be a source of reliable news that is trustworthy. They will do a synthesis of what has become a flood of undifferentiated information on the web, and I think that will actually have higher value than it has in the past. And I would say, actually, to talk a little bit about our paper here in Silicon Valley, and in a way maybe to take issue with one of David's point, and maybe it's a matter of perspective and time, but because we were sort of here at ground zero in this revolution, we've been at it longer than others. Indeed, I think, we've been on I don't know how old Salon.com is.
It's about the same as...
Yeah, we started in 1995, and so we've been out there for as long. And I would say that we've done a lot of distinguished journalism on the web. I would say, for example, that our coverage of the Microsoft trial brought together all of the best traditions of rich daily newspaper journalism with the power of the medium. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, while David says that newspapers are staid, we are online full-time in three languages, English, Vietnamese, and Spanish. We are innovating.
One of the questions from the audience is notes that you were among the first to do so. The San Jose Mercury News was among the first to be on the Internet. And the question was, if people can get their newspaper free on the Internet, how are you going to sell papers?
Well, we're selling more today than when we went on the Internet. It's a very high-value proposition. See, people come to the Internet, including Mercury Center on the Internet, more for information acquisition than they do for the experience for which they buy the newspaper 7 days a week. Those are related but different things. And so that has been enormously important. The other thing I point out is that the Internet has expanded our reach in a non-geographic way that is just fascinating. The audience of Mercury Center and SiliconValley.com, three-quarters of it is outside of the Bay Area, and 10% of it is outside of the United States.
Far out of your subscription area, then.
Yeah. And yes, those things are out of my subscription area. So it really has expanded us. Our Vietnamese product, a third of the subscriptions of the Internet traffic from there is outside the United States. So it makes our news organization, our newspaper, healthier. It expands our reach.
Well, here's a question from
quickly. To that. I think, by and large, that's very true, that there are certain newspapers like the Mercury, like the Arizona Republic, that were out in front, that have done a very enterprising job of adapting to this new world. But even there, I would say that the Mercury, I don't want to play financial advisor to you, Jay, but the Mercury did have a great franchise. You're here in Silicon Valley. This is ground zero of this revolution. And yet, in a way, what you could say, despite the terrific work you've done in covering Silicon Valley, and despite the fact that many people are clicking on your site from outside of San Jose just to find out what's happening here in Ground Zero, still CNET is the company that most people think of, or ZDNet, for online coverage of Silicon Valley. So in that sense, two upstart companies ate your lunch. I mean, to put it bluntly, there's no reason why the Mercury Center shouldn't have been there first and dominated, but somehow those upstart companies came in. And I think one reason is what we're talking about is the staidness, the sense that the newspaper culture is too conservative. When I was at the Examiner, if we got one letter, literally one letter from an angry reader, all hell broke loose within the newsroom, you know, because something was wrong. Who's responsible for this, you know? And often the reporter would have been right or the editor was right, but just the fact that we got an angry letter caused all sorts of turmoil within the company. At Salon, if we don't get one, at least one, a dozen, 100 angry letters, emails a day, we feel we're doing something wrong. The point is that journalism should provoke, it should anger, it should disturb people, and yet newsroom cultures have become very conservative, very, very safe, very timid. And not speaking in the vernacular of the web is a problem. Not being more youthful, not being more funny, more satirical in the kind of way that you write is very important online.
David Talbot from Salon.com. And here's a question from the audience that also should go to you. What's the present status of the Drudge Report? Does this mean there is no place for a whistleblower in today's media world?
Well, I think Matt Drudge... you know, I have a love-hate, I think, relationship with Matt, like probably a lot of people. I mean, it's a guilty pleasure. I read him often. He's kind of, I think, the id of the American newsroom, because whatever can't get out, you know, on NBC or the New York Times or Newsweek is leaked often to him by people in mainstream media. That's how Matt Drudge was created, by the mainstream media. He was there. He was kind of the way to evacuate, so to speak, things that couldn't be published. And so there's kind of, you know, there's some usefulness in that. I think the fact that he pushed NBC to air the Juanita Broderick charges against President Clinton, I think the public had the right to know those. Certainly what, you know, some of his reporting on the Lewinsky scandal also, you know, should have been brought before the public. But the problem with Matt Drudge is he's just a one-man band. He often gets things wrong. He notoriously doesn't fact-check. And he needs a newsroom behind him. He needs some of the standards and principles that the newspaper industry in this country has learned the hard way to do.
How would you bring him under control?
Well, Fox tried to, and Fox is not exactly, I think, the pinnacle of American journalism.
So, even they were offended.
Even they were offended. So I think Matt's going to be mad, and there's probably no way to bring him under control.
One of the things,
Bob Giles from Media Studies.
One of the things that I think eventually brings Matt Drudge under control is that the marketplace determines finally whether he's is trustworthy and believable. And as the marketplace makes that decision, Matt Drudge is either successful or he goes away.
Let me ask you, John Opendahl, the Arizona Republic, this question that comes from our audience. It says, will there be an economic divide between those who have computers and can access the net and those who do not, and who will rely on newspapers for news. Will this lead to a dumbing down of the print media?
Well, it's hard to predict what the cost of a computer is going to be, even at Christmas this year, I would say. There appear to be big changes coming both this year and next year. And whether there's a divide like the one you mentioned or the questioner has, I don't know that you can tell right now. An equally interesting question has to do whether newspapers become elite mechanisms or not. It's entirely possible that you could construct a future 10 years from now in which newspapers would become much more elitist and their advertising would be geared much more for an elite audience, and much of the rest of the traffic would be driven to some kind of electronic media, whether the media are television or radio or the Internet. And that doesn't necessarily have much to do with the price of computers or access to them, although that's a factor. I think you can see some factors that would push newspapers in that direction, including the price of newsprint, the loss of classified, and the habit of reading in the country, and whether or not the literacy levels stay the way they are right now or whether they drop.
This question for Jay Harris of the San Jose Mercury News. This is from the audience. Says, I much prefer getting my news from a traditional printed newspaper and then more specific information on the Internet. Does this seem like a trend?
Well, I think it is. I mean, it seems to me that what we're seeing here with the Internet is the continued evolution of the media environment in American society. It's the addition of yet another media stream. I think smart newspapers will look for ways to, and there are many good examples of how this has happened. Smart newspapers try to find ways not only to reach new audiences with the Internet, but to use the Internet as a complementary tool to serve the needs of readers more effectively. And I think there's an enormous amount of innovation going on in the industry to very good effect in that regard.
Here's a note from the audience that goes back to an issue we've been dealing with a good bit in this panel. Scenario, a rumor is reported on an Internet news/opinion site. It's picked up by a tabloid. Then a legitimate news source, a newspaper, reports on the tabloid's article, thus legitimizing the original rumor. What can be done to prevent this? Anybody want to take that? Alan Horton from E.W. Scripps Company.
Well, we are very careful not to report a rumor, even if it's showing up in the New York Times News Service or the Associated Press. I'm not saying we don't slip from time to time, but if there's something that smacks us as an anonymous source or a rumor, we do our own fact-checking on that. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of stories every day that get into our newspapers that may not have passed through a filter that is fine enough. But our general rule of thumb is that we do not print rumors unless we have verified the facts.
If it comes from a tabloid, we'd expect you to be suspicious, but are you equally suspicious of the Internet?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or for any other, I mean, this is not a dynamic that has changed. The only thing that's changed is the speed by which it happens. But newspapers have been getting tips from anonymous sources forever. And the good newspapers have never, ever reported tips without checking for at least a couple of confirmations of fact.
This question goes to issues of ethics. Do any of you envision an Internet version of the scandal with 60 Minutes and the tobacco industry? John Opdahl, the Arizona Republic, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen the movie. But, yeah, I think you can always construct a set of, confrontations like the story that you're talking about that could result in any form of media, whether it's newspapers or online or in any other format, I suppose. There are always going to be people who are going to blow the whistle, and whether they're credible or not, you have to go through the sifting process that Alan's talking about. I disagree with him a little bit, though. I think that the rules have changed somewhat. When I was a young editor in Detroit a long time ago, it was a lot easier to keep stories about rumors, not the rumors themselves, but stories about them out of the paper until you could check them out. But now I think with the addition of the Internet and the addition of probably a lot more television available in 1971 or so, that the story about the rumor can become a story. And that phenomenon is changing what newspapers do. And it's forcing newspapers to change their standards somewhat. I don't necessarily agree with the change in standards, but I think the momentum behind those kinds of stories, as disagreeable as it is, some stories like that end up in newspapers. And it's too bad.
Let's go back to the issue of newspapers having to seek additional sources of or other non-traditional sources of revenue as a result of Internet taking away classifieds, among other things. The Los Angeles Times recently was embroiled in a scandal where they did their weekly Sunday magazine on the Staples Center, the big center hosting the Lakers, the Kings, and so forth, and shared the revenue from that with the Staples Center. Is that seeking new forms of revenue that's tolerable for you?
Are you looking at me again?
Yes, I am. Alan Horton of Scripps.
Boy, I sure hate to criticize an esteemed newspaper like the L.A. Times. I really do, because it is a great newspaper. But they made an awful mistake. It is a way to seek new revenue, and if you're going to do that, you've got to be honest with the readers about it. You've got to put it on you, somewhere in a prominent way. You have to make sure the readers understand that that information is part of a special advertising section that is promotional in nature and is not news. And if one of the great things that newspapers do well, and one of the things that the Internet still does not do well, is to divide, to carefully label or distinguish between commercial speech and news. And they're both protected by the First Amendment, but they have to be carefully distinguished and labeled.
See, I would take issue with that as well. I think there are no similar scandals online in the Internet world that rank there up there with the L.A. Times Staples one. That's a doozy. Even Otis Chandler, the great publisher, former publisher of the Times, was forced to come out of retirement and level a blast against this kind of management at the LA Times. The Internet, no editorial operation on the Internet has done that. For all the kind of, criticism and hoopla about how we've let down the walls between church and state online, that's just not true. At Amazon, it's true, but Amazon's a store. It's a marketing company. But certainly Salon or Slate or CNN.com or any online operation, editorial, reputable online editorial operation that I know of, has never done that kind of prostitution online.
Bob Giles from Freedom Forum and Media Studies Center has something to say on that.
The Los Angeles Times episode, in one sense, is a distressing example of what happens when you have people on the business, running the business side and the publishing side, who don't have ingrained in their souls journalistic values. There's been a lot of written about the LA Times and breaking down the walls between news and advertising. I think in this case the wall was up. The news department did not know about this. It was made a decision made through the publisher's office, and I think the absence of a clear understanding of the journalistic values at risk here was part of the problem.
Question from the audience. How is the question of privacy protected in Internet journalism?
Whose privacy?
David from Salon.com.
Well, does the question, I'd like to hear from the questioner, whose privacy are you concerned about? Those of the people we write about, or?
I would assume that was the question.
Well, again, I think we would follow tried and true practices there. If someone, for instance, there was one story that we covered during the Clinton scandal, on the heels of it, about Pat Buchanan's brother. And Pat Buchanan's brother, some of you may remember this story, had a history of mental instability and at one point threatened an ally of Clinton, was found, I think, trespassing at this gentleman's home. Well, you know, we had to make a call on whether or not we should publish the address of this person. And, of course, I think like most newspapers would have decided, we decided not to. So I think it's important, particularly when you're dealing with someone who's not a major public figure, to protect their privacy as much as possible. I think, unfortunately, what we have in this country is a very strict two-caste system. And if you're a celebrity or a politician, God help you. Everything's fair game. But if you're not, I think the standards for protection, both online and offline, are still pretty good.
A related subject would be the fact that online, it's anonymous. You don't know who made the statement. You don't know who to blame. Jay Harris, how do you deal with that?
Well, I think one of the fallacies here is to talk about internet journalism as if it is a thing. I mean, it ranges from something as steeped in tradition as Salon or Slate or CNN.com to things that are utterly irresponsible. And I think David is right to talk about his organization, but I think there are a lot of faults with what's going on in the internet in terms of what could be called journalism, but it's very important for us all to own up to them. The internet is very much of a sort of Wild West frontier with very little self-policing and frankly a great deal of violation and irresponsible professional behavior.
To what extent, this is a question from the audience also, to what extent are newspapers affected by the internet's ability to present news and other information in a multimedia form, including audio and video?
I think what's going to happen is it's going to drive newspapers to at least experiment and then probably press on with their own attempts at new media. This year, for the first time, the Republic sent a reporter out with a video camera. An unsightly event, if there ever was one, this guy with his notebook and pencil carrying this gizmo over his shoulder. And he came back with some out-of-focus stuff we couldn't use. But I'm exaggerating a little bit. Nevertheless, clearly there are going to be some alliances and liaisons between newspapers and people who have their pictures move. And, in fact, I think that's going to happen more often than not, and there's going to be some kind of blending between or among the various media. Some of this is going on with the Inquirer in Philadelphia. Clearly, the Chicago Tribune has done a good bit of this. And it really raises the question about whether you need a television signal anymore. I mean, the restriction on showing...
Wait a minute. Whoa, hold on.
The restriction on showing moving pictures has been FCC policy and all that. But if you have a newspaper website and you can get access to AP tape, I mean, you can present it now. So it really raises some interesting questions about how you train journalists if you have, as most newspapers do, people now who are not necessarily adept at writing for the internet, try and get have them write for a broadcast. So it gets back to Bob Giles' statement earlier. I mean, if you've got a journalism school and somebody enters on the first day, what are you training that person to do?
Here's a question from a student, which may be apropos at this point, for any of the panelists. Student asks, where do you look to first for information you trust? And what newspapers do you read? Boy, talk about a straw man setup here. What would you recommend to students?
Well, I believe that students ought to read lots of different newspapers.
Alan Horton of Scripps
Howard. And lots of other things. Lots of magazines, and they ought to be on the internet, and they ought to be everywhere. It's a great time in your life. You'll never, ever be as excited about all the possibilities as you are when you're younger. You know, some of us get re-excited from time to time, but that first time you realize how wonderful the world is and all its dimensions is terrific. And at some point between age 16 and 22, most of us realize the world is a wonderful big place. And so the more newspapers, the more of every kind of media you can get your hands on, the better off you are when you're in that state. If the question is, what newspapers do we personally read, I read a number of our newspapers, but I also read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal every day. I would assume there are other people here who would answer that question differently. John, what do you read every day?
John O'Dell, the Arizona Republic who reads it every
fine
day.
Fine newspaper published down in the desert in Arizona. I think that it kind of raises another question, because there's a lot of information available on the Internet that is pretty unfiltered and biased. I can think back to a guy when...
Pretty unfiltered. It's completely unfiltered.
Well, there are some people who claim that they're filtering into making judgments, but a lot isn't. During the breakup of Yugoslavia, when there was a lot of violence in Serbia and Croatia, there's a guy in Phoenix who was, I think he had a website, he had two websites, I think, and he was publishing a lot of information. He was clearly pro-Serbian, and he was always writing me letters and wanting to get stories instigated and what have you. So I went to his website one time, and it was, to an untutored person, if a young person who didn't know any better went to that website and read this stuff, it was absolutely unbalanced. Sort of sounded plausible, but it was really, I could pick the facts out that were wrong, and I was not a student of the particular violence that was going on there. You could read this guy's stuff, and then you could go read the Times or the Republic or the AP or somebody, and you know that the guy was wrong. So, I mean, there, after a while, you'd hope somebody young who's looking for information would seek out some established filtering agent. I accused an editor once of being a filtering agent. That was pretty funny. Who's going to be able to make some editorial judgment and try and tell you what stuff is just plain baloney and not. And there are established places where you can go to do that, including this gents join on the web. If you're young, though, you'd, I think, like to have somebody tell you that, because there are standards of excellence, and they ought to be touted to people who are young.
And they ought to be taught. Bob Giles at Media Studies Center, you had a comment?
Journalism students up until a couple of years ago had only the, unless they subscribed to the local newspaper or bought the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, had only the copies in the of a variety of newspapers in the journalism school library to read, and they were usually 2 or 3 or 4 days old. Today, every major newspaper has a website, and any student can in almost real time, look at any newspaper, and should be encouraged to do so. This is really a wonderful source of finding out how newspapers are covering stories, making comparisons, learning about different communities, and comparing the styles of newspaper to newspaper around the country, looking at today's papers.
Do I detect the fact that our folks in print are suffering some of the same consequences of those of us in broadcasting, especially television, with the advent of cable, with the advent of satellites, when we had so much more competition? You're experiencing that now in newspapers, and the charge is frequently made that in television, particularly in television news and especially local television news, dumbing down was one of the responses. Make it easily understood by everybody. Reach for the greatest possible mass rather than a select audience.
What's the name of that Patti Loveless song, "You Could Feel Bad If It Makes You Feel Better"? I suppose there are some people in the print media who believe that. But I think what's happened, as he pointed out earlier, is that newspapers, I think, are going to get better as a result of the Internet, just as I think the phenomenon you discussed probably sharpened some broadcast journalism. Will there be a kind of a negative reaction among some newspapers? I suppose so. And are there applications on the net that are going to be cruddy journalism? Yeah, I suppose so. But I think if you've got more competition, what happens is you either get better or you get run over. And I think newspapers are responding. I can tell you case after case around the country, I think, including the Merck. It's gotten better and continue to get better. I think that's going to be a driving force.
You know, one key way I think the newspapers could go back to their roots and get better is revive the great tradition of columnists. I think column writing fell into kind of fallow times in the last few years. The older generations of Mike Roykos and Jimmy Breslins and Herb Cain here in San Francisco retired or died off. And really the newspaper industry should be a talent scouting industry, like any content industry, like any news or information or entertainment industry. And yet I think editors got a little lax and really didn't go out and develop the next generation of columnists. Columnists do very well online. There's something about, you know, a strong, colorful voice that leaps off that cold computer screen and makes you want to, you know, crank up your computer every day just to read what they have to say. Salon has really built a lot of its, you know, editorial operation around our stable of columnists, Camille Paglia, Garrison Keillor, Anne Lamott. David Horowitz on the right and Joe Connison on the left. And people really, I think, respond to that. So I would say that's one way that newspapers should, you know, respond to this new challenge. Go back to your roots. Newspapers used to have those great columnists every morning you woke up and wanted to read. And I don't see that as much anymore in daily newspapers.
Jay Harris of the San Jose Mercury News, what do you say to that?
Well, I would say that anybody who moves toward the lowest common denominator is enormously stupid and moving in exactly the wrong direction. The fact is that what we are doing and what the best newspapers around the country are doing is investing more in our journalism, not only in our local report, trying to report more informatively and fully on community life, but also in our report on national news and international news, news from the state capitol. That's really where our strength lies. I would also make the point that it is a mistake, I believe, to go too deeply into any particular niche. David mentioned earlier CDET and ZDNet, which are very tightly focused niche publications on the technology industry. We cover that, but that is certainly not all we propose to do. And I think to have committed ourselves to trying to do that only would have also been a mistake. Having a full and rich plate of information, news and information and fine writing for our readers on a daily basis is the greatest strength that we have.
Including columnists?
Oh, absolutely, including columnists, including great photojournalism. We had a powerful picture of a young protester on the front page of in Seattle on the front page of our paper today. And that had an enormous impact on all who saw it. That is where our strength lies, to become better and better at what we are and not to seek to become what this new medium makes possible.
Jay, can I just respond quickly to that? I think, yes, newspapers have to remain full menus for their readers every day. I think that's one of their strengths, to give people that kind of range and depth. But what would prevented the Mercury from knowing you have a franchise and covering Silicon Valley? You could still do this, but I mean, it would have been better to do this 2 or 3 years ago, to keep pace, keep, you know, hiring more and more reporters to cover Silicon Valley and spin that off as a separate business. Call it the Mercury Center. But that could have been
have
a separate publication.
Have you seen SiliconValley.com?
Not lately.
I'd advise you to look at it.
Bob Giles had some comments on this.
No, actually, I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just telling you that we have 3 minutes left on the panel.
Oh, all right.
Jess, I would
very
like
appropriate comment.
I wanted to make one comment because I agree with David. I think newspapers, by and large, became what one of our editors calls the dull machine. And we preach edge and personality. We also want reporting to be done from the center. But we want columnists to represent a personality. And we want our investigative reporting to represent an edge. And I think most of us on this panel would agree with that. And I think all of us are trying to develop more personalities than we did for a while. And I think it's always been true on our sports pages. And it's now returning to the other sections of the newspaper. And that's maybe a little too late, but better late than never.
To what extent is this a response to the Internet?
I don't think it is. I think it started before the Internet got to where it is. Talk radio is a big challenge now. As you know, something that's not come up here at all, we're talking about regulation, and I know we're about out of time. Newspapers are the only medium today that can't buy other electronic media in the marketplace. I mean, the Mercury News cannot go out and buy a television station in this market. But television stations can now buy each other. Radio stations can be eight radio stations in a market can be owned by one company. They can also own one or two television stations in the same market now. Newspapers will benefit greatly when that last hurdle is removed so that they, too, can compete across all media.
We come to the point in the program where we have only time left for one more question, and that question is, what do you see of the future relationship between traditional media and the Internet? David Talbot.
Well, despite my kind of contentious perspective today. I do think there's a lot of room for cooperation between the best of offline media and online media. You asked earlier, Jess, about multimedia. Salon, for instance, has a new deal with an audio company called The Dial, where you can use Salon as a radio station now and hear our columnists and news and so on in an audio way. We have a deal with CBS News where we're going to be getting video feeds from them to illustrate our political news coverage next year. So I think there's lots of ways for the old media and the new media to work together. Certainly the new media can learn a lot from the as I said earlier, in applying the kind of very important editorial standards and in terms of fact-checking and double sourcing or triple sourcing stories. And the old media has a lot to learn, as I said, also from the new media in terms of being more colorful, more enterprising, more irreverent.
Thank you, David Talbot of Salon.com. And if I may attempt to summarize, I think what we've heard here today is that the Internet is a major factor. It is influencing traditional media, especially print media. We will find changes occurring as a result of that, perhaps both. We would all oppose any First Amendment infringement. We would all like the Internet to adopt exactly the value, the standards and values that traditional media have had all along. But I think we all look forward to exciting times in this world of ours. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to moderator Jess Marlowe and our panelists, Jay Harris, publisher of the San Jose Mercury News, Robert Giles, executive director of the Media Studies Center, Alan Horton, senior vice president of Scripps Howard Newspapers, John Opadahl, publisher and CEO of the Arizona Republic and Arizona Business Gazette, and David Talbot, editor and founder of Salon.com, for joining us today. Our thanks also to the audience here in San Jose, as well as those listening on the radio. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.
Nice going. Cool. Well,